You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm C.J. Davis. In LA's Westlake neighborhood, there's a big, old-timey Art Deco building. On an ornate awning, gold letters spell out the Mayfair Hotel. It's a hip boutique hotel where you might want to go after work for a cocktail or maybe attend a party. Well, today, instead of hosting events and tourists, guests at the Mayfair are older or medically fragile homeless people sheltering from COVID-19.
I have my own bathroom. And they have the housekeeping once a week, which is nice.
Christine Curtis has been at the Mayfair for a couple of months now as part of a program called Project Room Key. City and county officials started it in the early days of the pandemic, and they started winding it down last August. But now a promise of new funding from the Biden administration is bringing it back to life. KCRW's Anna Scott covers housing and homelessness for us, and she joins me right now. And Anna, you know Christine really well, don't you?
I do, and you might recognize her voice from a series that we did over the summer called Samaritans, a podcast series where I followed Christine for a year as she went from the streets into eventually a group shelter. So she moved into a hotel room when Project Room Key first started last spring because she's 61 years old and she has various health problems. And she says that Project Room Key has been a huge change from being in the group setting.
Like night and day. There were 30 of us crammed into those little quarters with only two bathrooms. The sleeping part was fine with all those other women, but the bathroom part...
Mostly, she says, being in the hotel has been a good experience, but it is very isolating.
You know what? I don't go outside. The only time I ever am in contact with anybody is the three times a day when they come to hand the food over and take your temperature. That takes like 2 minutes. That's it. Very lonely. Extremely.
You know, when Christine was on the street and in the group shelter, she had a lot of friends. She was interacting with people all day. She's a very sociable person. And Project Room Key was supposed to be a temporary thing, but she has been in the room alone now for more than 6 months.
You mentioned the word temporary. It is a temporary emergency shelter, Anna. It was always that way. So now how much longer do officials want to keep it going?
Yeah, so back when it started at the beginning of the pandemic, Project Room Key was supposed to only last 3 months. But of course, nobody knew exactly how things would go with the pandemic, and it went beyond that. But in August, like you said, the city and the county started to close it down hotel by hotel, not because the need went away, but because of funding. Under former President Donald Trump, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, was committed to reimbursing 75% of the room rental costs for Project Room Key. But over time, it became very unclear if that policy was going to continue. LA couldn't afford to keep paying for it up front without that promise, so they started shutting the program down.
And by doing that, they, of course, started closing hotels. How many hotels, Anna?
In total, almost 40 hotels have participated in Project Room Key, and it has served about 8,000 people, not all of them at the same time. Right now, there are about 1,900 people left in the program in 16 hotels, and all of those were supposed to close by April.
Except now the new Biden administration is changing that?
Yeah, just a few weeks ago, President Joe Biden signed an executive order saying that FEMA should reimburse for all the costs of renting these rooms through September of this year, 2021. So suddenly there's this big push not only to continue Project Room Key, but to ramp it back up after it had been on its way out.
So that's good, right? What's the problem?
Well, the problem is that the city and the county still need to pay for the hotels up front, and it could be a while before FEMA pays them back.
In general, it can take years for the federal government to reimburse eligible costs.
That's Phil Ansell. He's the head of LA County's homeless initiative.
And he says it can take years. I mean, I'm assuming that LA can't afford to wait years, right?
Right, exactly. So city and county officials right now are really scrambling to try and figure out a way to take advantage of this money. You know, this might be the time for LA Mayor Eric Garcetti to put in a call to his buddy Biden and ask for a favor. But barring that, city officials are talking to state leaders about possibly getting a loan from them and then having FEMA pay back the state. Just yesterday, on Tuesday, LA County's Board of Supervisors asked their homelessness and budget people to come up with some suggestions for how overall the county could pay for its costs up front. They're also going to ask the federal government to consider helping with faster payments. So a lot of moving parts right now.
So local officials, Anna, really want to re-expand Project Roomkey. But what about the hotel owners? I mean, I remember that it was difficult to get many of them involved in the first place. Is it going to be any easier going forward?
Well, that's a really good question. I talked to one hotel owner who said she would absolutely do it again. Her name is Rachel Gerstein, and she owns the Shelter Hotel. It's a small place with about 50 rooms in Koreatown. It's actually where Christine first went when she entered Project Roomkey. Right before the pandemic, Rachel Gerstein says,
we had just renovated our hotel, had a brand new lobby, and we were super excited about the spring.
But then the coronavirus hit.
It was pretty instantaneous, right? You just see cancellations happening, fear happening. So the writing was on the wall.
She read about Project Roomkey at the time and actually contacted the city to participate.
Obviously, I think that it was a win-win in trying to house and shelter as many people as possible and get them off the state, you know, streets and keep them safe from COVID. But it was also, you know, a win-win from our staff. I mean, I could offer jobs back to my entire staff. And it was fantastic.
So she had a really good experience with it. She left the program in December because of the funding issue, but she says she is talking to the city about participating again. Of course, not every hotel owner feels exactly the same way. A spokesman for the Hotel Association of Los Angeles told me that one challenge this time around might be that with the vaccine, a lot of hotel owners are anticipating returning to normal business sooner than they were back in March or April. So that could hold some people back.
What about this idea, Anna, of the city perhaps commandeering hotels? I mean, this is something that's been suggested by homeless advocates since the beginning of the pandemic. The mayor Garcetti, as the mayor, the chief executive of the city, has emergency powers to force hotels to participate.
Yeah, that is something that advocates have been calling for. And actually, tomorrow, a city council committee is going to be considering a motion to explore that option from council members Mike Bonin and Nithya Raman. Now, the mayor hasn't really shown any interest in doing that so far. Speaking to lawyers, it seems like, yes, it is legally within his power to do. Now, this isn't a takeover, like taking hotels through eminent domain or something like that. It's more forcibly using them as shelter just for an emergency period of time, and the city would still have to pay for those rooms. But one of the obstacles is it could potentially lead to time-consuming lawsuits that would drag out beyond the emergency period and make the whole thing moot anyway. Whatever they do to try to re-expand this program, the city and the county have not yet set a goal for the number of people or the number of rooms that they want to add back in. And it's not really clear at this point how many people they're equipped to serve, because Project Roomkey isn't just about sticking people in rooms. It also provides meals and social services and housing assistance. So you don't want to end up in a situation where September comes when the FEMA money is set to dry up at this point, and then people get dumped back out on the street.
Is that what happened to the people who were already in Project Roomkey rooms last year and are not anymore? I mean, where have people from the project been going?
Well, some have returned to the streets, but the vast majority, about 70%, went to some other kind of interim temporary housing. That's according to the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority, which is overseeing this. Now, they only gave me numbers for the last 6 months, so we're waiting on a more complete picture.
So here we are again, right? The shortage of permanent affordable housing in Los Angeles, the thing at the heart of the homelessness crisis in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. And in LA's homeless services system, even if you have been matched up with some kind of permanent housing, it can take months to move in, which also complicates Project Roomkey and what is going to happen when it does inevitably end, even if it lasts all the way through September. Christine, for example, actually was matched with a permanent home last spring, but 8 months later, she still hasn't moved in. She's at the Mayfair Hotel.
Well, the more time that goes by, the more depressing it is, frankly, truthfully. Well, because it feels like it's never going to happen.
It feels so hopeless, Anna. I mean, why hasn't she been able to move in?
Well, it's not clear. I've been in touch with the social service provider that's working with her, and I'm trying to find out more. But what I can say is that this is not unusual for things to take this long.
KCRW's Anna Scott, who covers housing and homelessness for us. And Anna, you'll continue to keep us updated, right, on Christine's situation and on Project Roomkey as well?
Yes, I will. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Anna.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. And now, a musical interlude for justice. It's tenor and actor Curtis Bannister performing in Heartbeat Opera's Breathing Free. It's a virtual album brought to life in vivid music videos. The show makes its West Coast premiere tonight at the Broad Stage in Santa Monica. Well, not at the stage itself, rather in your living room, courtesy of the Broad Stage. The show features excerpts from Beethoven's Fidelio, traditional black spirituals, and songs by Langston Hughes and other black artists. And it includes the voices of more than 100 singers who are all behind bars, far from free, from six prison choirs. Curtis Bannister is the man with a powerful voice you just heard. He's here to talk about it, as is the show's director, Ethan Hurd. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Curtis, I want to start with you because your voice, my God, just powerful.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. How did you get into singing opera?
A little bit by accident. I was in undergrad at Towson University, just north of Baltimore, Maryland. And I was studying musical theater, and I ended up switching voice teachers about halfway through my studies there. And my voice teacher that started with me junior year gave me a song and said, sing this how you feel a opera singer would sing this. And I gave it a go, and he said, I think you might want to rethink your major. And I laughed and I told my parents that, and they were like, okay, all right, give it a go. And that was that. Open wide your arms to life.
Describe what folks who are going to see this will see in this production, Curtis.
I believe that Breathing Free is both allowing, permitting, and inviting people to see the operatic art form and classical music art form in a way that is long overdue, so that it's tangibly current, and so that other people that may not have been exposed to classical music or to opera will be able to watch my performance or watch Kelly's performance, my co-star, or Darrell's performance, or any of the dancers, and be able to not only hear the notes, but be able to see the passion and focus and drive that's behind each breath and each note that goes into it, and say, oh, opera isn't so much about different languages and these gaudy gestures and over-dramatized facial expressions, but it actually is real. And when you're able to see it on a screen, it makes it that much clearer.
Ethan, I want to bring you into the conversation as well, because as the director and the co-founder of Heartbeat Opera, I mean, in this production, you've got this six-member cast of black singers and actors and dancers and the band and the several prison choirs. I mean, what was going through your mind and the idea behind the show? How did it all come together?
You know, the idea for Breathing Free was born over the summer. We had plans to bring our 2018 production of Fidelio to the Broad stage in person. And when the pandemic hit, we realized we needed to reinvent our seventh season. And we also wanted to respond to the racial reckoning in our country and around the world.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, there were a lot of things going on back in the summer, right?
For sure. Yeah, we wanted to make a Black Lives Matter opera and figure out what that could be. And we decided a song cycle or a visual album would be a beautiful way to weave Beethoven in with the works of Black composers and lyricists. And so it's been a truly inspiring and humbling journey making it, you know, collaborating across the country. Our amazing filmmaker, Anais Sisko, traveled to Chicago to film Curtis. We had another team in LA filming Durrell. Meanwhile, everyone was recording their audio tracks independently at home, often in their closets for acoustic reasons. And then we edited all of the audio together in a very painstaking process. So it feels miraculous in a way that it came together, and we're thrilled to be sharing it on the West Coast.
I want to hear one of the songs featured in Breathing Free. This is a traditional African-American spiritual called There Is a Balm in Gilead. That's just gorgeous and so powerful. Curtis, describe the music video that accompanies that song and what it was like to perform. Because again, we're talking about power. We're talking about passion.
So one of the main things that brings that entire piece together is the choreography that goes along with it. And movement has always been a part of the Black experience, especially when it comes to spirituals. The body is an extension of the voice. And doing the movements during that part, it was a cold day in Chicago, but the sun was really, really bright. It gives a better understanding of what each person is singing and what the words actually means when you're leaning over and you're holding yourself, where there are parts when we're taking our necks and just going around in a circle, and at many times our faces are hitting the sun at a certain part, or we're down towards the ground, just rocking ourselves back and forth, whether that be a march of defiance or a march out of sadness or a triumphant march.
I mean, Curtis, damn, everything is so supercharged right now, especially after last summer.
Yes.
And you know, the street protests and everything else going on. What role do you see for yourself and other artists when it comes to the issues of civil rights, which is just over and over and over again in this country?
I think as artists, we have a very special opportunity to use something that everyone loves and everyone appreciates and bring awareness to what's going on. You may not understand, or somebody might turn off what they're listening to if they hear someone telling them something. They may feel like they're being preached to, or they may feel like they're being berated in some way. But if you see an artist sing about it or dance about it, and you ask the question, oh, that dancer looks like they're in such pain, what does this leg extension mean? Or what does pas de bourrée mean? Or what does this plié mean? It feels like there's a certain sort of darkness or heaviness to it. Or when you're singing, it's like, it feels like that note just goes on forever, but there's a tear inside of it. Or that line is really, really choppy. It almost sounds like you're crying. What does that mean? When people ask questions and curiosity is heightened, then as artists, we're allowing people to get to the core of what the issues actually are.
Ethan, you have singers in this performance who are in prison that are featured in this production from across the country. I want to hear some sound of the Hope Through Harmony Women's Choir. This is at the Dayton Correctional Facility in Ohio. Ethan, so I guess the question is, how did you get all this collaboration? That had to have been monumental, Herculean.
You know, it was step by step. I want to give a shout out to Dr. Catherine Roma, the conductor of that choir. She conducts two other prison choirs in Ohio who are also a part of this collaboration, and she's speaking on the panel tonight at the Broad, along with Michael Powell, who was a former member of the Coogee Men's Chorus in Marion Correctional. You know, back in the summer of 2017, we asked ourselves, you know, could we collaborate with prison choirs? Might they be interested? And we reached out to a friend, Amanda Weber, who conducts a choir in Minneapolis. And she said, yes, we'd be absolutely interested in participating. And she connected us with Kathy and Kirk and Kansas and Mary and Iowa. And they all asked their choirs, would you be up for learning the Prisoner's Chorus, O Welche Lust, in Fidelio? And would you be up for learning the German lyrics and the four-part harmony? And week by week, month by month, through a lot of emails, we put together this network and got permission from the wardens and the various correctional facilities. We were able to visit four of the six choirs in person and film rehearsal. And then we edited all that footage and audio together into a really moving music video. And it really was, I think, a life-changing experience for me to collaborate with these incarcerated singers. It's completely changed the way I think about the story of Fidelio and the idea of breathing free.
Curtis, what's it like hearing those voices from the choir, from the prisons, incorporated into your own performance?
It makes it more human. Going off of what Ethan said, I wasn't there, but I remember the first time both listening to it and watching them, it brought much more heightened awareness of what the incarceration system in America is like. It obviously, unfortunately, historically, has affected people of color far more in a much more tyrannical way in many cases. But hearing and seeing prisoners sing a song about joy, about light, about healing especially, there's one line in there where the men's chorus is singing and you hear them say, it's light against dark, something along the lines of, will we ever get out, or what is life like out there? And seeing those men and hearing those voices and then seeing the text there, it brings a real life heaviness to it, an awareness of wanting to get involved in some way. And they sing it quite well.
It's gorgeous all the way around, by the way, and I want to congratulate you all, seriously.
Thank you.
And I encourage, I mean, if you haven't seen it, it's beautiful, it's powerful, it's sad, but it's uplifting. There's so much going on there. Ethan Hurd, the co-founder of Heartbeat Opera, the director of its latest show, Breathing Free, and Curtis Bannister, rising star, man. We're going to see a lot from you, too, and here, by the way. I want to thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
And by the way, you can check out the production, which is actually happening virtually tonight and Saturday. Get tickets, which start at just $10, at the Broad Stage, B-R-O-A-D, stage.org. Thank you. That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, trying to find the right one or even have some casual fun in an all-consuming, fast-spreading, life-changing, even sometimes deadly pandemic. Love is really elusive.
Normally, you're waiting to date the, like, boring, perfect guy when you're ready to get married, because you still want to go out and have fun and, like, hashtag hoe life. And there is no hashtag hoe life right now. Like, you know, you can't go out with, like, all your single girlfriends and, like, live your single life.
No, there's not. So what are you doing, presuming you're single and available in the realm of love and dating? Are you still going out with people in a safe way? Maybe not so safe, in which case we do reserve the right to judge you. How are you dealing with being single and fulfilling your need for love? That's tomorrow. Tell us about it at kcrw.com/askgreaterla. We want to hear your story. kcrw.com/askgreaterla. And while you're at the website, subscribe to the podcast, too. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Kat Yore, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Mario Saavedra, Amy Todd, Jody Adler, and Christian Bordahl all made the show happen today. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thank you for your ear. Have yourself a great day.